Thanks, Ryan. Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Marcia Stone, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. Oh, my. Hi, I'm so glad to see you all here, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight. For those of you that don't know, Jonathan Stone's our speaker this evening, and he just happens to be my husband as well. And he also comes out every Wednesday to teach Big Book to the residents that are here, and to share his experience, strength, and hope with that. And for anyone that knows Jonathan, he definitely has a way with words. He's very much a teacher, and he has an amazing story before and after, as the Big Book says. You all are in for such a treat tonight, and I'll say one thing about Jonathan. I learn from him every single day. He challenges me to be a better person, and he challenges me in my recovery process. He's probably the most disciplined person I've ever known. And I'll tell you something that I love about him. If he tells you he's going to do something, he's going to do it. And I think anyone that knows him can attest to that. So I could not be more happy to introduce our speaker. And like I said, y'all are in for a real treat. So come on up.
Need some water. Hey, good evening. I'm Jonathan. I'm an addict and alcoholic.
Hey, Jonathan.
And, you know, it's always a real privilege and honor to be able to come out here and talk from this podium specifically. I do some talking in and around Austin and some other places, but, you know, whenever I come here, this is where the magic started for me. And so it always holds a special place in my heart. So I'd like to thank whoever put me on the slate to speak. Who's in charge around here? No, but I've been looking forward to this for a couple months, and you know, everyone was asking me, are you nervous? And I told them all, no, I haven't even really thought about what I'm going to say, and that's usually, from my experience, the best way for things to happen. I pray to be a channel, and you know, my role, as I understand it tonight for this next hour, is to talk a little about what it was like, what happened, what I'm like now, and to explain, hopefully experientially, how I've developed a reliance and some conscious contact with a power of much greater than I am. You know, I had a birthday this week. I turned 45 on Thursday. I got sober when I was 40. My sobriety date is May 13th, 2008, and you know, that has come about from, first of all, God's grace, second of all, lots and lots of work with newcomers and sponsorship, consistent meeting attendance, and doing these steps. And as you'll hear as I go throughout my story, you know, it's not like, I told you my sobriety date was May 13th, 2008. I didn't try to start getting sober on May 12th, 2008. You know what I mean? It was years and years and years and years. I'm not one of those guys that just came in, got a white chip, and went to treatment and then got it all. And hopefully I'll be able to convey some of that. I prepared for this talk tonight by getting an hour and a half massage at 12:30 to 2. So maybe I should have made it a 3-hour. That's how I'm feeling. So I wanted to talk to you guys a little. And first of all, I wanted to say welcome to all the families. You know, the other weird thing is, you know, like I said, I speak a lot. And me and Marcia, in fact, go to this this local prison and talk to 200 strangers, men and women, once a month. And I'm not nervous at all. And I know probably 90% of the people in this room, and I'm a little jittery. You know what I mean? It's weird the way that that works. Anyway, I just needed to put that out there. I was born and raised in Texas. To a wonderful family. A wonderful family. Wonderful parents. Mom and dad that believed in me. Told me that I could be whatever I wanted to be. There was no abuse. There was no molestation. and I have a sister, a couple years younger, grew up in the same identical household, and has no problems with drugs and alcohol, and has no problem really with self-centeredness, which the book says is the root of my problem. She, just without having to do these pesky 12 steps, can go and be concerned about other people and ask follow-up questions. You know what I mean? Where's Bill? Yeah, there he is. And the reason I think that it's important to talk about upbringing and stuff like that, I mean, there's plenty of speakers that get up here and talk about, you know, the rough childhoods they had and, you know, growing up on the streets or, you know, a broken home or lots of molestation and abuse and stuff like that. And, you know, my experience working with guys that have had that kind of upbringing is my ego wants to blame that for what's wrong with me, you know. And I have nothing like that that I can hang my hat on, you know. If my alcoholism and my drug addiction was circumstantial, then I'd really be some kind of anomaly because I don't have any kind of, you know, rough thing to really look back on. You know, I do remember this, though, and I remember this ever since I can remember. From birth until 40 years of age, I've had this innate resistance to follow anyone's direction other than my own. That's 40 years of experience with that, all right? One of the examples I can remember growing up, and as a kid, I was very high strung and I was agitated, and I never was comfortable. All right, I don't remember how old I was, but I wasn't able to walk yet. All right, and I only remember this through pictures, but I was in my crib, and my mom tells me the story that she went in time and time again to try and lay me down, try and lay me down, try and lay me down. And anyway, it's a weird thing, I think. I haven't heard of anyone else doing it. Anyway, she finally comes back in, and I'm falling asleep standing up in the crib. I'm asleep over the edge, standing up. I mean, you know, standing up, sleeping. Because I just wouldn't calm down, you know. And there's lots of experiences that I have like that, you know, from all the way up until I got sober. Not falling asleep standing up, but similar type of experience. The other thing that stands out to me in my childhood is that I was blessed or cursed with a keen intellect, with a thinking mind. And I was surrounded by people that always told me how smart I was. And I was put in gifted and talented classes. And I excelled in school without trying. And, you know, at the time, I just thought that that was a lucky thing, you know, and a benefit. And it's still, you know, to some degree, I think that it is. But I tell you what, if you're like that, you may have some trouble getting sober. You may have some trouble getting sober, like I did. So anyway, up through middle school, high school, I think I took my first drink when I was, 14, 15 years old, something like that. I can't tell you. There's some people who stand up at the podium and say, I remember my first drink. I don't. I just remember, you know, liking it when I started it and doing it as often as I could. You know, I said this before, too. And this is kind of a common theme you hear from people from the podium, too, and lots of people out there in the residence and anyone else that's in recovery. I always felt like I wasn't in on things. You know what I mean? I was musically gifted too, and so I participated in the band in like middle school and high school and stuff. But then I was also a funny guy and a class clown, and so I was kind of in the popular crowd too. But the popular crowd didn't really like me because I was, you know, playing the tuba or whatever it was. And then the band people, you know, didn't really like me because I was kind of, you know, a mole that was over there with these people when I should have been really over there. So I just never really fit in. And you live that way long enough, and you live that double life, then it starts to twist your insides up. You know, it starts to twist your insides up. Anyway, the next, I guess, really, really big significant thing in terms of growing up was I went to an all-male military school in South Carolina. And I went there in 1986 and spent 4 years there and really honed the perfection of my alcoholism while I was out there. There was no girls, all guys, and really encouraged lots and lots of heavy drinking. And, you know, oddly enough, even though that's really where my drinking took off, I attribute lots of my discipline that Marcia was talking about, and lots of my adherence and stuff in the structure that I like to live by and stuff like that, to the 4 years that I spent there. So now looking back, I can see, you know, both the pros and cons. I got out of the Citadel and I wanted to do some kind of graduate school, but I wasn't really sure what. Anyway, most of you guys know, all the residents here that I know and everything know that I'm a veterinarian. I went to vet school. And starting in vet school is when my narcotics usage really took off. I had some injuries and some allergies and stuff and was put on opiates and really kind of took off there. And that, I believe, around the early 90s is when I crossed that imaginary line that the book talks about. Now, I never could have told you that at the time. This is a looking back process. But I was in trouble. That started to get my attention. My alcoholism and my drug addiction really started to get my attention in probably the early 90s. I got into vet school. I want to touch base with you guys, at least some of the stuff about the using and drinking I want to talk to you about is examples of times where I should have woken up. Right? Everyone has those. Wow, looking back. That really should have got my attention. If I was a normal person and this happened, then I'd probably go ahead and put it down. And I have dozens of those stories, and so does everyone in here that's a real addict or alcoholic. But, you know, I got kicked out of vet school 6 months short of graduation for stealing a bottle of morphine. I picked up a couple of felonies, all right, while I was in vet school, all around opiates. After vet school or during vet school, I got married, had my first son, Wyatt. And that was a very dark time of my life. Not having Wyatt, obviously, but that marriage was a very desolate, empty relationship. And looking back now, I was the primary cause of it. When that marriage ultimately dissolved, I went to a treatment center in 2002. I went to treatment that first time in 94, and that's where I met Mark Houston for the first time in 1994. My second attempt at treatment was in 2002, and that's where I met Marcia. For you guys that don't know, me and Marcia met in rehab. Don't recommend it. wasn't smooth sailing at all. We definitely paid the price for that. You know, I think we could have really benefited from a place like this where there's some separation, you know. But anyway, 2002 came, and I tell you what, guys, like I said, ever since my alcoholism addiction, you know, got my attention in the early 90s, I was going to meetings. I was going to meetings, and I was trying my best to stay sober, and I just was unable to. I didn't have any kind of the solution. No one that I can remember ever brought to me anything specific about these 12 steps. I mean, I read them on the board, but that's about all the understanding I had. And then I read the book, and it just was like a novel to me. I needed teachers, and the teachers were to come. But at the time, it just flew over my head. So anyway, in 2002, I had a brief stint of sobriety. And I'm not even going to call it sobriety, abstinence, all right? I had 3 years where I wasn't doing any alcohol and wasn't doing any drugs and, was going to meetings, all right, and trying my best to be a better person, et cetera, et cetera. And it just wasn't working. That lasted for as long as it lasted. And in 2005, I relapsed, all right? From 2005 to 2008 was a very dark place for me and Marcia and anyone that knew us. All right. Cocaine entered the picture, and then crack cocaine entered the picture, and all the while we were still drinking. During that time, our recovery program together was kind of based on acquisition of things and accumulating and getting back what we had lost and stuff like that. And that fed us for a while. I mean, I could keep myself afloat above, you know, so I keep my eye out for the alcoholism and addiction. When I get new things every once in a while, you know, but I would keep sinking under and under and under. And then in 2008, all the wheels fell off. She ended up going to Atlanta, and I ended up coming here. And when I was here, I was across the street where the females are now. That was the male residence. And I kind of want to get into fairly quickly what happened here. And what it's been like for the last 4.5 years. Like I said, when I got here, I was a treatment professional. You know, I had been to tons of treatment centers. I showed up well. The counselors told me that I was going to do good. And, you know, you get your book and all the people sign in the book. Hey, good luck. We'll see you out there in the real world. All that other BS that doesn't ever make a hill of beans. Anyway, so... And the circumstances and kind of the coincidences that started happening as soon as I landed here were just very, very odd. You know, and I didn't recognize them at that as that at the time. I just thought, I mean, I wasn't thinking about it at all. But I almost went to a different place. I won't name names, but I almost went to a different place in Austin. And then I happened to go to this meeting in Austin, and someone talked about Mark Houston Recovery. So I talked to my mom. She was going to help me, you know, get out here. And so this is where I landed. I don't know what would have happened if I had not landed here. Anyway, so I spent 3 months here, and I started having an experience with this big book, you know. The same book that I had been reading since 1994, 1995, that I heard read in meetings but just didn't have any connection with me. Didn't have any connection with me whatsoever. But I had some teachers here that helped me look at stuff. And the residents that are here know how important I believe that first step to be. It was the difference in my recovery. And my experience working with other guys is that it's impossible to go through the rest of the steps without a solid first step. All right? And I didn't know what that was. You know, I introduced myself earlier as an addict and an alcoholic, and I'm so grateful today that I know what that means. That I know what that means. Because for the longest time, I just thought, well, I'm an addict and alcoholic. Well, first of all, because my parents and the vet school and the lawyers and the cops, they all tell me I am. So I guess that must mean I am. And I go to AA meetings, you know, and bad stuff happens when I drink and I do drugs. And I thought all those things together is what made me addict and alcoholic, you know. While all those things are true, that's not what makes me an addict or an alcoholic. 100% what makes me an addict or alcoholic is my specific relationship to alcohol and drugs, period. You know, some of the stuff that I'm going to talk about tonight, you know, especially for the family members, I think it's important for you to hear me when I say, you know, the felonies, the house foreclosures, the sketchy stuff, the repossessions, you know, all of the violence and the seedy places that I went. None of that stuff has to happen to your loved one. It really doesn't. It had to happen for me, and I'm here to share my experience. But all that kind of stuff doesn't make me addict or alcoholic. What makes me addict or alcoholic is the fact that when I was here in 2008 and I could take a look back at my 25-year or whatever it was history with alcohol and drugs, is once I started, I could not with 100% certainty predict how it was going to go every single time. And then whenever I had episodes of abstinence with good stuff happening in my life, knowing that I couldn't 100% predict, I always found myself putting drugs and alcohol back in. All right? And then that third component of step one that I could relate to is kind of that kid that wouldn't lay down in a crib, that lived that way for the next 40 years. And that is that wherever I'm at, there's something better over there. Right? When I'm in high school, I can't wait to get to college, and then I'll be happy. When I'm in college, I can't wait to be a veterinarian and go to vet school. No, now I need to go get married. Now I need to have some kids. Now I need to go buy this. Now I need to move here. The very fact that I can't ever be comfortable where I'm at or with what's going on around me is the third component of that first step. All right? One of the things that, you know, I get to do being a veterinarian is to go to the continuing education kind of conferences. And me and Marcia went, I guess it was a couple of years ago, and I heard a lady speaking, and it really made sense to me. She was talking about the reptilian brain and you know, all kind of neurobiochemistry stuff and stuff. She was lecturing on addiction, and, you know, kind of the school I come from, that really doesn't make any difference to me. You know, I think this is a spiritual thing and a spiritual problem, a spiritual solution. But what I did get was this analogy out of it. I started thinking what it was like when I would have long periods, or not long periods, but long enough to where there was nothing in my system, and then I put drugs and alcohol back in my system. All right? And I know I empathize with lots of the family members that are here that have had to experience that. All right? But this is what it was like for me, and this is what it's been like for lots of people that I have sponsored and worked with. If you hold my head underwater for long enough, lake, pool, whatever, in time, I'm going to fight and stuff like that, but in time, why will I drown? I will drown because I breathe underwater, right? I get so uncomfortable, I have to take that gasp. Now follow me here. There's nothing in my mind. My mind, right before I breathe underwater, doesn't say, "Hey, Jonathan, I bet you can breathe water." Right? Nothing has changed. I'm still very cognizant and aware of the fact that I can only breathe air, yet I'm underwater right now. But what happens is I get so uncomfortable with that lack of oxygen that drive supersedes any kind of rational cognitive thought that I have. I take the gasp underwater and I die. And that is what I experienced time and time and time again, right? In the fall of 07, I had the opportunity to go participate in a family week with Marcia, and I had every single reason in the world to stay sober. I mean, she was my using buddy. But she was sober. She'd been sober for like 5 weeks. I had kids at the house. I wanted to be sober, right? I had done a whole lot of cocaine and alcohol and pills leading up to this family experience, family weekend experience. And I was down there for 5 days. 5 days. So when I'm done with the family, I've got nothing in my system. Nothing at all in my system for 5 days. There's nothing within me demanding more, right? But I start experiencing that drowning. I get home. I'm trying my best just on willpower and desire and an attempt to please Marsh and everyone else that wants me to stay sober. I really want to not use. But that desire and that drive and that five-day experience being with Marsha and cheerleading her, yay, yay, we don't drink today, and you know, all that stuff. That lasted for me. I think I left that treatment center at about 3 or 4, and that lasted till about 8:30 that night. And at 8:30 at night, I loaded my 2-year-old son in the car and went to the dope house. You know? Not wanting to. Not wanting to. And that's the key part, guys, of step one. You know, everyone has always told me, right? If you do something, that must be because you wanted to do it. And being a scientist and a thinker, I buy into that. I buy into that. But one of the things that I was able to do during my time here was to look back on my experience and see, there was lots of times I didn't want to, and I did it anyway. And if you have some experiences like that, welcome. Welcome. That first step is getting more solidified in your experience. You know, the other thing I got to here is once I qualified myself and I knew there's no good news in step one, I knew how screwed I was. I knew how screwed I was. And based on my experience and going to multiple treatment centers, I knew that when I got out, It wasn't a matter of if, it was just when I was going to relapse again. Because, I mean, I might go 2 days, I might go 2 weeks, I might go 6 months, I may go 2.5 years like I did that one time. But I am going to put drugs and alcohol back in my body. That's just my only experience. I had no reason to think any differently. So when I rolled in here in May of 08, I didn't think that it was going to be any different. I sure as hell didn't think that 4.5 years later I'd be sitting here talking to 200 people. You know, that wasn't anything that was on the horizon. I was so shattered in 2008. And I was so aware of how much trouble I was in. That 40-year belief system of having difficulty following directions, always having to see how it was going to end, and you make sure that you convince me that it's in my best interest, then I may think about doing it. You know, those kind of thoughts. All that was out the window. All that was out the window. And I started doing things that were counterintuitive to here. Because I had a slew of evidence that showed that it didn't work for me. All right? You know, one of the other important things when I was here is my conception of God in step two. You know, my dad was a minister. I wasn't an atheist. I wasn't an agnostic. I totally believed in God when I came here. And my problem was I didn't have any access. All I had was a theoretical intellectual belief that there was something, but definitely not something vital and interactive with me. All right? And so that's another real important part that I learned here, you know? And I'll tell you right now, guys, today, you know, my conception of God, I hear people talk, and this may be offensive to some people, I'm sorry, but I'm not really sorry, but but, you know, I don't like hearing people say stuff like, God is testing me, or God's sending me hardship, or anything like that. I just can't believe in a God like that. I've got no desire to turn my will in my life, in step three, over to the care of something that's going to screw with me at times. I'd rather just go drink and smoke crack. I mean, honestly, you know, that'd be a better deal. That'd be a better deal. I don't think that God sends anything but goodness to me. Now, life sometimes happens, right? And people who have free will sometimes do spiritually sick things. But I cannot buy into the idea that God zaps me just to see how much I love Him and stuff like that. That doesn't work for me. That doesn't work for me. While I was here in 08... when I got to that third step, guys, you got to know that my whole life, especially once kids started coming into the horizon, and I had 5 kids by now, 2 biologicals, 3 stepkids, and I really, really, really just wanted to be a good dad. That's what I wanted, you know. But if you've got alcoholism and addiction like I do, then anything that stands in the way of its progression will be carved out of your life, right? Job, spouse, finances, career, work, home, kids, interests, anything, self-esteem. It needs to be bulldozed away so it can progress, all right? Knowing that I wanted to be a great dad, I really wanted to be a good husband to Marcia. I wanted to be a good husband to my first wife, too, my ex-wife. I didn't have the power, you know. I mean, I just couldn't do it. But when I took a look at step three here, this was a very hard decision to make. I mean, it's all about making the decision that it talks about in the book. And my decision looked like this in 2008. God, you know I love my wife, and you know I love my kids. But if they stand in the way of me living on a spiritual basis or trying to attempt to do your will, then keep them the hell out of my life. Now, you guys don't have the same experience as I do, but that was a very critical, harsh decision for me to have to make. And I'm not saying I did it, you know, jumping and jiving. I was crying. You know, it was a very sad decision, but I was so clear. She can't keep me sober. My kids can't keep me sober. Being a veterinarian can't keep me sober. What I drive can't keep me sober. Where I live can't keep me sober. You people going to the meetings with you people and getting coffee afterwards can't keep me sober. Right? Now all those things can add unto my life, but none of them can keep me sober at certain times. So, that's kind of where I was at in the summer of 08. I wanted to talk, kind of the last half of this talk, some about some of the miracles that happened. When I got out of Mark Houston recovery in August of 08, I went to the sober house and I stayed there for 3 months. And I think it's still the same, I'm not sure, but you know, back then you needed to get a job within a week or at least be looking or something like that. Like I said, I was a veterinarian, but I didn't have my license anymore. My license had been taken due to lots of misbehavior on my part. All right. So I got out in August of 08, and I went on Craigslist or something, and I just looked, and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, you know, and I knew I wasn't going to really be making decisions. I was going to have them be made for me and try and seek guidance and stuff like that. But I thought, you know what, I still would kind of like to keep my foot in the door. All I know how is to be a vet. I'm definitely not a handyman. You can ask Marcia. I can change a light bulb. That's about it. You know, I can't do any kind of stuff. I blow stuff up and break stuff. And you know, so I couldn't do it. It's not like I could go be an AC repairman. You know, I didn't have any skills. So I thought that I was going to be, I just, you know, try and stay in the profession. I went on Craigslist, and this very first ad, I sent a resume to or whatever, and I met with a lady. Told her that I used to be a vet, but I'm not anymore, and I'd be interested in working as a technician in her hospital. Now, first of all, to be able to accept a position like that after being a doctor should have some reflection to you all about my level of willingness and my degree of ass-kickedness, right? I'm a doctor, right? I laid it all out on the table. I told her about cocaine. I told her about alcohol. I told her about everything. And she said, well, come by, you know, come by for a working interview. I think that, you know, you may be able to work something out. Now, I don't know. You guys don't know the veterinary profession as much, but there's probably 200 vet hospitals in Austin. You know, there's probably 200. My guess is that the vast majority of them probably wouldn't have hired me living in a sober house 3 months sober. Just got my license taken. I don't know. I mean, that's just, I mean, that's kind of the way that I thought about it. So I showed up. And I walked in, and sitting at the reception desk was a girl that I had seen in AA meetings. There was already a employee there. You know, so I started putting two together. I'm like, well, this is pretty cool. I started working there. I'm still working there today, only today as a veterinarian. You know, so that's 4.5 years later. But I worked there, and I stayed there for a year, making $9 an hour, cleaning up poop and pee, doing laundry, taking out the trash, and receiving direction and orders from another doctor, right? But I was ecstatic. I was ecstatic, you know? I started making some amends, and one of the amends while I was living in the sober house that I did was I went out to North Carolina to try and straighten up this third felony charge that I had picked up. And I went out by myself. I was staying in a hotel. I showed up at the courthouse. And they called my name. And now, mind you, I knew all this was coming, right? I knew all this was coming all the way back since May when I first landed here. So I had, this was probably October, so I had 6 months of knowing what was about to come around the corner, right? And I don't know how, I'm just letting you know, I didn't try and pull strings, I didn't try to call my attorney, I didn't try and say, you know, oh my gosh, I got two felonies, if I get one more, I may go do time. Do you think I'm going to do time? How much time do you think I'm going to do? I didn't do any of that. I was in the sober house, working full time, sponsoring guys, going to meetings, and trying to make my amends. And part of my making it right was to go out and turn myself into the court. So I went out there, and they called my name. Jonathan Stone, I don't know the person's name that calls the name, but not the bailiff, but someone like that. And they said, a year earlier, me and Marcia had been busted together. In fact, we rode in the cop car together, in the back seat. I can't remember. Anyway, we got busted for possession of crack cocaine and paraphernalia. Or I did. She tells it, I was the stupid one. I kept it in my pocket when the cop came, and she got rid of all her stuff. So she still got, but I got the charges. But anyway, so when they call my name at the courthouse, I'm like, here it goes. You know, I got two felony convictions already. Here comes the third one. I have no idea what's going to go on, but I still don't have my wife with me. I still don't have my kids with me. I'm making $9 an hour. They need me at the vet hospital, but I guess if I got to do time, I got to do time. And a little court person says, the state of North Carolina versus Jonathan Stone, possession of marijuana. Now, did you hear what I just said? I didn't have any marijuana. I had crack cocaine. And for you guys that are familiar with the legal system, there's a huge difference between possession of crack cocaine and possession of marijuana, right? Now, not only that was a little one, but then also, when the judge called my name and started talking to me, he said, Dr. Stone, he called me doctor, he said, Dr. Stone, I want to let you know that I have a certain history with you type of people. I have a son-in-law that's in treatment right now for substance abuse, and he's a physician. Now, out of all the judges that I could have shown up for on that day, I could have also showed up in front of a judge whose little girl had gotten killed by a drunk driver the year before, right? But I didn't, you know? Another little thing that happened, all right, that kind of showed me in my experience that I was doing the right thing. You know, one of the other things that happened when me and Marcia did get pulled over that time, Marcia told me, the cop with the drug dog, Marcia's like, Jonathan, we're in trouble. I said, why is that? She's like, I represented, Marcia used to be a lawyer, she said, I represented the wife and I totally dragged that guy through the coals. And he's coming with the drug dog. And me and you are in this Mercedes and it's about to get dirty. And so I was like, all right, well, here goes. And sure enough, you know, we never really talked to him much. I mean, I got popped, she got popped. But, you know, for the longest time, me and Marcia both individually had certain resentment against this guy. Because, like, you know how it is when you first land here. It's not anything I did. It's just bad luck and misunderstandings and, you know, cops are out to get me and all this other, you know, BS. But anyway, so, for the longest time, we kind of blamed that cop. Man, if it wouldn't have been the guy that Marcia didn't represent his wife, then, you know, maybe he'd been cooler and stuff like that. Well, the other thing that happened when I got to North Carolina and faced those charges is this. We found out that guy went to the judge on me and Marcia's behalf, and he said, you know, I don't know Jonathan that well, but I know Marcia, and she's a real stand-up lady. And if possible, I think you should be a little lenient, you know, with him. He was responsible for me getting like a deferred adjudication on my third felony, you know? And some of those things, if you're awake and you stay sober long enough and you go and try and clean things up, you can change your past. You can change your past. Because my mind told me for the longest time, that guy's a butt. You know what I mean? He tried to screw us over and blah, 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 blah. Well, you're awake, you show up, oh my gosh, he's my biggest ally. How would I ever know him? You know, how would I ever know? You know, time went on. I kept on, you know, putting one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. Marcia came back here, I think, in about I don't know, Christmas or so of 2008, but we still didn't have our kids. Kids weren't with us. And we spent the next, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, her getting, you know, into the community, the recovery community with the women here, and me getting into the recovery community, continuing to with the men, her doing her program, me doing my program. And you know, that's another time when we were like, oh my gosh, I know there's people in this room. I want to see my kids. I miss my kids. I need my kids with me in order to be okay. I need my kids with me in order to stay sober. Having my kids not with me is so uncomfortable, I don't think I'm going to be able to stay sober. Right? And I tell you what, you couldn't have convinced me at the time. But looking back, I needed every single day that those kids were not here. Every single day. Now, did I miss them? Of course I did. Of course I missed them tremendously. But the truth is this. If Marcia had come back too early, if the kids had come back too early, they would have been obstacles, not blessings. They would have been obstacles to me relying on God and doing this deal and making my amends and staying current, you know, and just all the stuff. They came back eventually, all right, in about 2009. You know, my life today is absolutely fantastic, probably 95% of the time, honestly. You know, now do I have bad days and I fall asleep and I, you know, snap at Marcia, of course, and you know, I'm not that great of a dad to the kids sometimes, of course. But you know, not one time in this 4.5 years I ever got my eye off the ball or lost hope. And I had lost hope for the longest time, probably from the time I was 30 to the time I was 40. You know, I had no real sense of direction, no purpose. You know, it's so wild. I tell people now, think about all the things that you would theoretically think that I would be able to have purpose about. Being a veterinarian, being a dad, being a husband, right? Having a nice car, having a nice house, having some money in the bank, being the funny guy, whatever. Right? All those things failed me, ultimately. They really did. I have one primary purpose today, and it comes right out of that book. And it's to help other addicts and alcoholics. You know? I get paid fairly well, but it's, being a veterinarian is kind of a hobby. Honestly. It's a hobby. This is what I like doing. Having the guys come over to my house on Sunday mornings. That's what I like doing. That's what feeds me. That's what makes it possible for me to keep going. You know? Giving away what was so freely given to me. You may be wondering how I got my license back. And if you're not, I'm going to tell you anyway. In I think probably May or June 2009, you know, I'd been working as a tech, you know, making $8 or $9 an hour or whatever. And again, that's another instance, guys, where Jonathan on his own power would have been calling that board and hiring a lawyer and saying, look here, I spent all this money in vet school. I'm sober now. Don't you see how sober I am? Let me be a vet again, blah, blah, blah. But I didn't. I didn't do any of that. You know, I just talked to the contact person at the veterinary board, and they're going to have a hearing. So I went to that hearing, and I was totally going to be okay regardless of what the decision made. And that's how I felt going into that thing. And Mark Houston sat right here, right next to me. And the other doctor that I began work for earlier that year sat on that side. And we just all talked to the board. They convened. I was kind of nervous for that 15 minutes, you know. But they came back and they said, okay, you got your license back. They have every reason to never let me practice veterinary medicine again, you know. But I'm working. I got my license back. And I don't want to be, you know, I definitely want to end on more of an upper. But, I mean, there's been struggles too, you know. We've had financial problems. We've definitely had kid problems. I mean, you know, co-parent, blended family, you know, all that stuff. You know, Marcia's mom died. Mark Houston died, you know, a few years ago. So there's definitely been struggles. But I can't tell you how blessed I am to have a life partner who understands her first step to the extent that she's real clear that her problems are of her making, and I'm clear on my problems are of my making. That makes for a real wonderful relationship, let me tell you. Because for the longest time, 98% of my problems were of Marcia's making. You know what I mean? And I needed her to do things a little differently in order for me to be okay with myself, you know? But, you know, walking this life path with someone that's walking a parallel path, but we're not this anymore. We were this for the husband and wives out there. Your husband's in treatment, your wife's in treatment, you just got out, whatever. We were like this for 8 years. I mean, wherever I went, I didn't have really many guy friends. She didn't have really many girlfriends. You know, and that's the way that we ran on the street. That's the way that we did dope. You know, I mean, it was a very sick, twisted, interdependent relationship. Nowadays, there's some days I don't even talk to her. You know what I mean? I'm busy doing my thing. She's on the phone 24/7. You know, and we reconvene in the bed at 9:30, watch a little TV, and, you know, we're asleep early. You know, that's not how it always was. That's not how it always was. She's helped me a lot. You know, I was on the phone with a sponsee, I don't know, it was probably a few months ago, and I was probably too short with him. Or I wasn't probably, I was too short with him. And Marcia said, I wouldn't want you to be my sponsor, talking like that. And you know, my first response was, well, you don't, but I took it. You know what I mean? I took it and I sat with it. And you know, the same thing happens the other way around. You know, Marcia complained about the way the kids are acting or something. And I say, well, you train the kids to treat you that way. Wow. Huh. You know what I mean? For us to be able to sit there and kind of give each other feedback and really be each other's cheerleader and stuff like that, I mean, it's fantastic. You know, it's fantastic. And none of that would happen without a conscious contact with God and having such devoted attention to service to others. That is the key. That is the key. That was what was missing so, you know, for so many years. And I was just going to meetings, trying not to drink and use one day at a time, and you know, counting the days, and it was me versus alcohol or me versus drugs. You know, I always lost. I always lost. What I found through this process, you know, the book never tells me at any point, okay, now you need to quit drinking. Never. What it tells me is that this AA thing is a way of life, a design for living that really works. And what I found is I adhere to the design for living, and as a byproduct, I don't drink or drug anymore. That is the key. As long as my crosshairs were on the drugs and alcohol, it was me versus drugs and alcohol, I always got my butt kicked. All right? But if I can set down my preconceived notions, my idea that I'm different than you, or my case is unique, or whatever it is that I'm saying, and adapt these spiritual principles that the book talks about wholeheartedly, then as a byproduct, I just don't have to do drugs or drink anymore. You know, it's an amazing thing. You know, me and Marcia have also been so blessed. We went to Costa Rica earlier in March and were able to participate in a big book study. You know, I talked to you about going to the prison once a month and talking to those inmates. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff. When we get home, sometimes we're silent and just, you know, vibrating in our seat because it feels, you know, I mean, just from the effect produced. And sometimes we chat about it. But that's been a very vital thing over this last, you know, year. In January, we're going to be able to go and do a big book workshop for the Northeast Young People's Association in New York, in Saratoga Springs, with one of our heroes, Chris S. Next week, we're going to be at you know, Fellowship of the Spirit, which is in Long Beach, California. So looking forward to that. So anyway, my life is full. You know, today I live a life of invitation. I'm invited to go places. You know, that's a real miracle. At the end of me and Marcia's using, toward the end, our life had gotten so small. And you guys that have fallen far down that scale know what I'm talking about. We couldn't even go outside the house. You know, I was stuck. I was stuck in the house, and I had no numbers on my phone. The kids were gone, the careers were gone, the house was gone, the cars were gone, and it was just us. you know. And to see that little tiny circle, just over 4.5 years, start ballooning back up, you know. Went out to dinner last night with some great friends, you know. I have tons of people that I can talk to. I have tons of people that I can call. You know, this deal has just been fantastic. So, the other thing I wanted to tell you, this is my most prized possession. You know what this is? I can't even read it anymore. My 7-year-old gave it to me. You know what it says? Number one dad in the world. Now, that may not be the truth. But the fact that he picked that out and gave it to me, based on how I treated him, based on my abuse and neglect, that is fantastic. And that is unbelievable. And I don't have the power to pull something like that off just by wishing it, you know? Just by wishing it. It's such a pleasure, guys, to come out here on Wednesdays and talk to your family members. I meet with the girls and then I meet with the guys, and you know, I always learn so much. Like I said, I'm not an authority on the Big Book. I don't speak for Benchmark. I don't speak for AA. I don't speak for CA. I just have lots of experience with working with lots of people. I have lots of experience with where self-will gets me, you know, and that's the treatment center after treatment center after treatment center, relapse after relapse after relapse. You know, bad things happen. Bad things happen. And I'm so grateful that I was given this window of opportunity. You know, that's what we have here, guys. We have a window of opportunity, and it's closing. And it closes at different rates for different people. Our job here, trying to get sober, is to get through that window before it closes. Sometimes it'll last a couple days, sometimes a couple weeks, sometimes a couple years. But you need to get through that window, get through this process, while there is yet time. Because the window will close, my ideas, my opinions, my judgments will all come back, and then it will be much, much more difficult to follow direction. All right? Anyway, again, thank you so much for the families for coming. Thank you so much, the Sharps, for the food, and thank you for letting me talk.